Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. It is Tuesday. Happy Tuesday. I'm taking a quick little break, but I'll be back tomorrow with fresh new interviews. For now, we'll take a listen to a program at the Commonwealth Club with Ronan Farrow. Today's program is brought to you by Pacific Fertility Center. When life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com.
Hello, I'm John Zipperer, the host of the Commonwealth Club's week-to-week political roundtable. You can find out more about week-to-week, including how to attend a program when you're in the Bay Area, and all about our nearly 500 programs a year at commonwealthclub.org. Today, Week to Week presents another fascinating program from the club.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode, and tonight it is my privilege to be in conversation with Ronan Farrow, investigative journalist and author of the new book, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. So positive, for which he interviewed every living Secretary of State and some who were didn't seem like they were living, among many others. He's also the newly, that wasn't in here. He's also the newly minted winner of the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for his journalism. On Harvey Weinstein and the culture of sexual harassment in Hollywood and beyond. There's so much to discuss, so let's get started.
Let's do it.
So let's talk about first, wait, I don't know where to start. There's so much to discuss with you. Let's start with...
We also go way back, and I still owe Kara because she really went through the hell that was appearing on my midday cable show.
Yes, that was an exciting moment.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I owe her.
I don't think I was think really nice to you.
Both people who saw that program.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I owe them a lot.
Yeah.
You were nice. I think you were great.
I think I said you look like Joffrey on Game of Thrones. That's your problem.
I think that was your problem, but now I think we have the audience beef.
At the time, and he was killing a lot of people. He's dead now.
I think that's also probably pretty fair, the Joffrey comparison.
Well, at the time, I was saying at the time, that's what I thought the problem was. But really, it's midday program on cable, really, is the issue.
It's tough.
Nonetheless, I'm sure you have a huge television career in front of you.
I'm at HBO.
Yes, that's right. Yep. That's right. You're working on that show. We'll talk about that, too. That's not gone up yet, though. You're working on it.
No. That deal starts in a month or two. And obviously, you know, I was on the Today Show for the past few years.
Right. Exactly.
Yep.
So we'll get to NBC and all your television stuff. But let's talk about the books. Let's start with the book, because I do want to get to Harvey Weinstein, because today I think Ashley Judd said she was suing.
She did.
And we'll talk about that. But let's start about the book, because it wasn't... First of all, when do you find the time right now? Because you jump from topic to topic. But talk about how this book and how you got into doing this. You worked for the State Department.
Yes, I only look like Joffrey. I actually have more work experience
than
Joffrey. Yes,
I know. You're 30, although I suspect secretly you're 102. But
both probably true. I am quite old-fashioned and not very cool. I mean, you see the shoes I'm wearing.
Yeah, I do.
And, you know, I went to school really young. I was a big nerd, and I had this kind of Doogie Howser trajectory where I went to college when I was 11. And, and so I started working early, and that was partly journalism. You know, I was doing UNICEF advocacy in Sudan and a number of difficult African conflict zones,
right,
and trying to tell stories that I felt weren't getting enough attention there. And actually, a lot of that aligns very closely with the reporting I ultimately did on sexual assault for The New Yorker, because I was telling the stories of survivors of rape as a weapon of war in Sudan. And a lot of that ran in The Wall Street Journal, in The Washington Post, The LA Times. But I was just kind of cold submitting these rinky-dink op-eds. You know, they were small pieces of commentary. I went off to law school after that and was at this inflection point where I was considering whether to go back to, you know, a big corporate evil-ish seeming firm. And some of you clearly have been
so
there.
So many to choose from, but go ahead.
Yes, so I mean, it's the only kind they do there. But Richard Holbrooke, who I had interned for years before, who was this larger-than-life veteran diplomat, came along and was putting together this kind of Ocean's 11 heist team of weirdos and outsiders, which literally was the phrase that was used to describe it by a very senior military official in this book, weirdos. And, you know, he was an incredibly persuasive guy. Very difficult, huge ego, but really behind certainly one of the great examples of modern peacemaking in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And Henry Kissinger once said, never say no to Richard Holbrooke. Mm-hmm. You'll eventually say yes, and it'll be painful getting there.
Right. Right.
And so I took that to heart,
and I
went off to Afghanistan.
Right. So also a fascinating person. He was large in life. I once had a lunch with him and watched him eat an entire basket of bread, but that's another thing. It was fascinating.
No, he was not a delicate eater.
No, it wasn't.
It
was everywhere. I wasn't going to say, because it's not very nice, but he was like had a lot of things to say. So you went over there. You went over. At what age were you at this?
I was by then 20. I was, you know, mm-hmm. no longer a wunderkind.
Okay.
And as Holbrooke liked to point out all the time, you know, you're not a kid genius anymore. Mm-hmm. And we were in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Washington going back and forth. And one of the trends that I watched unravel on the ground was the shrinking space for diplomacy.
Right.
And how if you wanted anything done, whether it was getting a well dug or, you know, starting dialogue with a community on the ground in Afghanistan, you kind of had to do it through the Pentagon, because mm-hmm. that was the only place we had capacity left.
Right. So this was happening well before what's happening now. The
Absolutely.
Ideas. And why? What was the, from your perspective, was the declining role of...
So there's several answers to that. One is that it's a vicious cycle. Every time we slash away at America's diplomats and what we invest in them...
Which has been going on for a long time.
Yes. We create a situation where American diplomacy is less useful because it's mm-hmm. been hobbled. And that takes years to regenerate. Mm-hmm. And we haven't been doing that. So... You know, I talk about how after the Cold War, the Clinton administration came in and presided over budget cuts to the State Department that are on a similar scale to what we saw under Rex Tillerson mm-hmm. and the Trump administration. You know, 30% cuts over the course of the 90s. And you talk to Madeleine Albright, as you said, every living former Secretary of State is on the record in this book, you know. Albright will say, well, that was Jesse Helms' fault. You know, this
right.
was the fault of a Republican Congress. And then you talk to Republicans who were in congressional leadership at the time, and they say, well, no, it was the Clinton White House. And the truth is, both are true. You know, both are to blame for how we treated the State Department during that era. But if you look at how Warren Christopher, Clinton's mm-hmm. first Secretary of State, sounded going onto the Hill and saying, here's why we should slash our State Department to ribbons, he sounded a hell of a lot like Rex Tillerson mm-hmm. in a more recent era.
Right.
You know, the commonality is that administration after administration sees this low-hanging fruit of diplomacy and development is just 1% of our budget.
Right.
But it's easy to talk about dusty bureaucrats not getting anything
Foggy
done.
Foggy bottom.
Yeah, yeah. So if you want to... not take the political risk of saying, hey, maybe we need to rein in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. If you are already in the thrall of...
And we can use the Pentagon as effective, presumably, or it's effective in whatever we want.
It's effective, but I think what I chronicle in this book is just how many long-term costs there are that we don't see up front if all we're empowered to do is think tactically.
What mentally happened, because if it hadn't started, because Tillerson sort of synopsized that idea of cutting the State Department, and the backlash was massive for him, and we'll get to him mm-hmm. in a second. But what did it start as? What was the impetus for this happening?
Well, if you go back to that example during the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. the impetus was, as James Carville put it, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
You know, we're refocusing on the domestic. We're not going to spend on these international boondoggles anymore. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of arguments rest on, I think, a really dangerous set of misunderstandings about our diplomats, who are fundamentally brave men and women mm-hmm. who get crappy pay and drag their families around the world to difficult places, often dangerous places, and give up opportunities to have a cushier life in the private sector to serve this country and to make us safer, to screen dangerous people from coming in. They're the first line of defense, to broker the deals that can keep our brave servicemen and women out of the line of fire. This is really important work, but because of the optics of peacemaking being, you know, less easy to understand mm-hmm. than making things go boom, very often on the campaign trail, these are the guys that get
right.
the shaft.
They get shaft. But it's interesting because we have a conception of ourselves as the Secretary of State being the most important, one of the more important roles, and we have this historical number of Secretaries of State who have been so prominent over the course of the entire of U.S. history.
She says this because she watches Madam Secretary.
I do.
Yes.
And I right now wish Tia Leone was indeed Secretary of State. But that's
I think Tia Leone would make a great Secretary of
she
State.
Looks
she
good,
would look fierce.
She's sensible. Yep. She always solves everything by the end of the program. She just solved a crisis in the Suzanne yesterday, last
Congrats,
night.
Congrats, Tia.
It was great. And then she made dinner for her handsome husband. And they were adorable.
It's a very accurate show.
Yeah, yeah. So, but the conceptual idea is this Henry Kissinger. This is an exciting. I just heard a very interesting anecdote. I hate to drop a name, but I was at a dinner with Tony Blair, and he told an anecdote. It's like such. I just dropped so many names. I just can't. He told
for
it. I have
listening
to,
on the podcast. I just to, gave the audience a look like.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying, he said it. I don't want to take responsibility. I didn't say this. He gets credit for it. But apparently, someone went up to Henry Kissinger and said, "I hear you're fascinating. Fascinate me." So you have to fascinate me.
Which, that person sounds terrible.
I know
but
it
go
does,
on.
But I kind of like it. But we have that idea of this swaggering Secretary of State and stuff like that. But it's a canard then, from your perspective, that we don't give it the kind of respect it deserves because we want to do might over.
Well, we're talking about two different things here. I mean, there are the career foreign service officers,
right.
You know, from whom you often have ambassadors and high-level leadership mm-hmm. positions filled, but who are separate from the political appointees who come in,
right.
Which is, you know, mostly what we're talking about when we say a Secretary of State.
Right.
I think that the denigration of those career officers is a real problem
mm-hmm.
and is one of the things underpinning this repeated slashing away at the State Department.
Did you ever want to join, become a diplomat? I was in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown.
Really?
Yeah.
So
I wanted to be a spy, though, so that's different.
You'd be good at both, to be honest.
I might be one right now, and it's the best cover ever.
Well, I may also be one, Kara. But technically, they are not supposed to have
right.
journalist cover stories.
Supposedly. Allegedly.
Supposedly, allegedly.
You would be like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but without all the sex. But go ahead.
Kara, first of all, the night is young.
Okay. All right. Okay. It's not happening, Ronan.
I just, you know, she's always rebuffing me.
I am, constantly.
So
for good reason.
You know, I'm interested, actually, in your answer to this question, because even when you were in school looking at this decision, I think that the prestige of the profession was already in
No.
It was better than it is now, for sure.
Yeah.
But you clearly decided not to go that route.
Because I was gay, and there was the process was terrible at the time. At the time,
yeah.
I'm super old, but it was really bad at the time. And I remember the interview was terrible. It was all about being out. And I'm like, I am out, but if you were out, if you went to Saudi Arabia, it was ridiculous. It was an insane thing. I would have done it.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, actually, because right now, obviously, one of the points of contention during Pompeo's confirmation mm-hmm. process was his views on this issue. And in the soup of fears evoked by his hawkishness and mm-hmm. his willingness to stand lockstep with the president on the rolling back of major diplomatic accomplishments. Mm-hmm. There is also, I think, for many foreign service officers, including openly gay ones who talk in this book, a lot of fear about this Rises. Particular strain of conservatism coming into
a
now very liberal department.
Yeah, absolutely. Greatest hits. So talk about this idea of if you have all these different things around the world that are challenges right now. Let's let this lead up to it. One of the things you were talking about was the last sort of very prominent Secretary of State was Hillary Clinton. How do you assess her? Because Trump attacks it a lot of the time, a lot of the deals they made during the time. How do you assess that tenure?
So here's the interesting...
Because people thought she did a great job, for example, during that time.
And I reported to her for several years while she was in that job. Mm-hmm. Here's the interesting and complicated thing about the story of the Obama administration when it comes to diplomacy. So people think of Obama standing there in Cairo and talking about peace and the importance of not just relying on military solutions, which he used that kind of language a lot. But in fact, there are a lot more pros and cons when you look at Obama's diplomatic legacy. In this book, War on Peace, you have people like Ben Rhodes speaking mm-hmm. very frankly about the fact that for much of the first term, for many of the major policy reviews, they were somewhat snowed by a culture of celebrity generals, which is mm-hmm. a phrase that you know Ben uses when he talks about this. And Richard Holbrooke's story ends with him fighting for peace negotiations in Afghanistan for some kind of a political settlement and being rebuffed partly because there really wasn't any room for points of views that weren't lockstep with the military's
That's true,
view.
Right.
And so that's the kind of the con, that mm-hmm. when I was there for the first term, you know, and that's when Hillary Clinton was there, obviously, there was a very, very hawkish, militarized climate in a number of different policy processes. There was a consolidation of power at the White House to the exclusion of the empowerment of diplomats, and I talk about how that echoed around the world. And people like Samantha Power are, again, frank about saying kind of mea culpa on that. But I will say, in the second term of the Obama administration, which I was not present for and Secretary Clinton was not present for, an interesting thing happened, which is, by the admission of a lot of these officials, they course-corrected. And they spent a few years really investing in large-scale diplomatic endeavors. Mm-hmm. And by the end of that second term, in just a few short years, you had the Iran deal, as controversial as it is, certainly a serious mm-hmm. diplomatic undertaking. You had the thaw in relations with Cuba. Mm-hmm. You had the Paris Climate Change Accord, right. All in rapid succession. So I think the Obama administration gives us both lessons, how dangerous the militarization of foreign policy is, and also how quickly you can pull out of the nosedive if you choose to.
Don't go away. The Michelle Miao Show continues right after this.
The Commonwealth Club is a unique organization that brings together people from a variety of backgrounds to explore important issues as a community. Sooner or later, everyone worth hearing comes to our stage. From Marga Gomez to Richard Chamberlain, from James Hormel to Kate Kendall, leading thinkers, activists, politicians, and artists have come to the Commonwealth Club of California. Ted Olson and David Boies came here to discuss their winning legal strategy for same-sex marriage. Jason Collins talked about gay athletes. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence discussed activism and good works. Actor and director Rob Reiner explained how he got Hollywood behind same-sex marriage. Barney Frank described what it's like to be gay at the highest levels of Washington. From healthcare reform to transgender rights, from immigration to gay-owned businesses, it's all at the Commonwealth Club. And that's still just a portion of the 450 programs we present every single year, with new programming nearly every single day. Be a part of the conversation. Learn more at commonwealthclub.org, download our free app in iTunes, and join us in person the next time you're in San Francisco. The Commonwealth Club of California puts you face-to-face with today's thought leaders.
Babe, I think we're ready.
We're really doing this.
Yeah, I'm ready for our family.
So where do we start?
Starting a family is a team effort, and when life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. As a unified team of the best fertility specialists, guided by the highest ethical standards, Pacific Fertility Center provides patients with compassionate fertility care. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com.
Right. So let's talk about today, because a lot of people feel, you know, your piece and then your the section of this book about Rex Tillerson was the decimation may now be so damaging that it's not recoverable, although I suspect it probably is recoverable. But the concept of this particular Secretary of State and what happened here in a very short period of time. So we'll talk about that, and then I want to go through a couple areas and switch over to
So to be clear, I'm not drawing an equivalence between what happened under Obama or George W. Bush and what's happening
now. More a militarization of diplomacy.
Well, I think it's a difference of degrees. What is happening now is an unprecedented new extreme. There are lessons to be drawn from history where we have tried this before. We've seen a little bit of this movie before, but this is a much bigger production of it. We are laying waste to the State Department. Within days of the Trump administration assuming power, there were these just mass purges of our career officials. And yes, to an extent, you know, political appointees come and go, and they leave when new people come in, but this is different. These were, you know, people who had been there for decades, with expertise in some of the most important challenges we face in the world, just unceremoniously being given the boot. Positions that have not been completely wiped out, as in they no longer exist, are left unfilled. There are embassies without ambassadors everywhere. There are regional offices across the State Department without assistant secretaries of state. Everyone is an acting official. It's chaos.
And is this by plan or by not plan?
I think that it is by plan without a care in the world for the consequences. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a White House that it appears simply does not want to deal with or engage with our diplomats or the idea of diplomacy.
Or use them.
I mean, Rex Tillerson was a great crystallization of just how bad it can get in terms of a Secretary of State who firewalled himself from all of the experts in the building, who presided over these incredibly deep budget cuts, who really was seen as the willing executioner of the State Department. And he's more candid on the record in this book, in one of his last interviews, than I've ever seen him. I think that he was
starting... Like I ran Exxon and now this...
He was right. He just ruined
Twitter.
His legacy. So, right. So perhaps he was approaching the point of giving zero f's.
Yeah. So talk about our relations, right? Great. We just had Macron here. Angela Merkel came and ran as fast as she could back to Germany. It looked like
after a few sassy looks.
Yes, doesn't work. It didn't work for her. But Macron did, you know, whatever he was doing with Trump. It was. Like Kaja Full 3.
Dug a grave, I think.
I don't know. I'm not sure what was happening. I have to say it was the happiest Trump has looked in a long time.
Well, he loves
not that there's anything wrong
putting
with that.
People down. No, we love for
not,
the president to be happy.
Yeah.
But he loves the move of like, you know, oh, there's a fake speck of dandruff, let me take it off. You all caught that moment.
Right. Yeah, I saw that.
I guess that's a kind of diplomacy.
Yeah. So how are we looked at around the world, and especially with the Russians so aggressively intruding themselves in our national affairs?
So the question of what this has done, this war on peace has done to our relationship with our allies is a really important one. And the answer is, you'll be not at all shocked to hear, very troubling. Mm-hmm. You know, Angela Merkel is one of the many international leaders who has sort of repeatedly had to say, frankly, extraordinary and unprecedented things about the United States because we are no longer viewed as a trustworthy actor.
Right.
You know, this happens in all sorts of situations. She's been very frank in her alarm about our posture towards North Korea, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly that's true of Macron, too. You know, you see him in this most recent trip saying, yeah, sure, maybe another Iran deal, basically as a Hail Mary pass to try to not have this administration blow up an agreement that will, A, if we pull out unilaterally and sabotage the thing, drive a wedge between the United States and all of its European allies, mm-hmm. B, send a devastating message to the North Koreans at a time where we desperately need them to believe that if we strike a deal, we will stick to it.
Right.
And see, you know, potentially reinstate a rising nuclear threat that we had at least temporarily contained for the sake of the whole world.
For the period of time we did. So North Korea, they're meeting this week. It was like another bunch of photo ops.
So,
I'm expecting him to appear on the cover of Vanity Fair at any moment. So, you know what I mean? Like, it could go either way.
And I think that's the point. Obviously, we all hope sincerely that this moonshot of, you know, Kim Jong-un meeting with President Trump will be productive.
Right.
However, time will tell whether that's actually the case. And I tell the story of...
Because they've done that. They have come this close before.
We've seen this movie before, and we've heard these exact promises before, and they have turned out to be lies. We have gotten played before. I tell the story in this book of the decades of diplomacy around North Korea and the reasons why it failed, and also the reasons why it didn't completely fail. And we might have been better served not to walk away from that diplomatic progress, and why the situation we're in now is partly a consequence of the periods in which we did walk away, like during the Obama administration.
How do you assess Trump's strategy here? I mean, it's basically, I'm going to be crazier than that guy and then see what he does. It seems like, I mean, he said it. It's like,
actually nothing wrong with that as part of a toolkit of diplomatic options.
Right.
I think if you have a controlled craziness and you can deploy that at will, that could be really powerful.
Yeah.
But it's got to be embedded in a set of expertise and individuals who know the pressure points and the history and the ways in which they lie again and again and the concessions that you should take and the ones that you should not.
The crazy part seems to be working, but the second part, I know a lot of the people on those desks are gone.
Gone. And you can really just directly contrast what the staff around this looks like now versus what it looked like during the Bush administration, where under Condoleezza Rice, there were these six-party talks. Mm-hmm. And I tell the story of the diplomat who led those, you know, this really tireless endeavor where, you know, although it fell through in the end, we got them to shut down one of the reactors for the first time in years. We made huge inroads in our relationship with China around this. And any long-term solution to contain North Korea is going to involve China.
Right, absolutely.
You know, they're the only players who have leverage there. We made progress, and then we walked away from it. And right now, we are not going back to leverage those gains. We are throwing it all out of the window. He is doing diplomacy by tweet. There's going to be this one-on-one meeting. As you say, the experts who once steered this process, during that Bush era, there was a huge unit of North Korea experts who really knew the region. That's no longer the case. And
well, he's saying it. They didn't get it work anyway, so what's the difference if I do it this way?
Exactly. And I think that that is an ahistorical view. And I think if you look at what those experts and diplomats accomplished, it is not inconsiderable. And the people who know where we screwed up before and who know how we affected the modest gains before are the guys you want to be listening to right now,
right,
where we desperately need those views to embed this moonshot of a leader-to-leader meeting in a long-term strategy.
Like just Pompeo and who?
You know, it is very difficult to see how this administration can turn this around, given realistically what the president seems to think of diplomacy and how little he seems to care about empowering America's diplomats. Mm-hmm. Mike Pompeo is a more experienced government operator than Rex Tillerson was.
Mm-hmm.
As much as people are fearful about what he might bring to the table, the career officers that I'm talking to who were brave enough to, you know, turn whistleblower for this book are hopeful as well. They hope that he'll be able to stand up to the president more, mm-hmm, and that when the president says, actually, this guy is much more on my wavelength than Rex Tillerson, actually, that's maybe Pompeo knowing how to play the president better.
Mm-hmm.
There's a White House official who describes Mattis's approach to the president in this book and says, I believe the quote is sort of doing Mattis's voice, whatever that sounds like. Like, mm-hmm, yes, Mr. President, you're so perfect, Mr. President. You won so much, Mr. President. You know, but here's an alternative view, Mr. President. And, you know, that White House source gave that anecdote in the context of saying Rex Tillerson never got the hang of that.
Right.
So maybe, just maybe, Mike Pompeo...
Obsequious ass-kissing to get what you want.
Sure. And maybe Mike Pompeo knows how to play that game better and will therefore be able to actually advocate for the State Department.
What would
Department.
Be a win in
leadership.
North Korea? And then I want to move on to your...
What would be a win?
Yeah.
I think that any concession in terms of their nuclear ambitions is at this point a win. And any actual verifiable, inspectable gains in terms of dismantling their nuclear capacity is a win. But again, much more so than Iran, this is a regime that has cheated in the past when we've struck these deals and given incomplete or inaccurate data. I even describe an incident where they turned over that incomplete data on pages that were tainted with enriched uranium.
Yeah.
Like the pages that were supposed to say that they didn't have the enriched uranium.
Oh, they're funny, those.
They got a sense of humor. So, you know, all of which is to say, you need experts keeping an eye.
It's an enriched manipulative.
Yeah, you need experts keeping an eye on this.
Plus, they preside over a vicious series of internment camps and all over.
Of course. Well, so I'm glad you raised that, because one of the things that falls by the wayside, I think, as a consequence of this trend of the militarization of, mm-hmm, American foreign policy is human rights. It's one of the first things that goes out of the window when you're dealing with warlords in a really expedient way and strongmen, mm-hmm, in a really expedient way, and all of the relations are general to general and, mm-hmm, spy to spy. That said, I think one of the misunderstandings about diplomacy that gets exploited and weaponized against the State Department is this idea that these deals can be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That diplomacy can look complete. Realistically, what happens is what you got in Bosnia, which was a difficult and imperfect agreement that gave too much power to the aggressors and maintained a lot of the factionalism and ethnic strife. Lots of reasons to critique that deal. But also, it stopped years of bloodshed.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, the Iran deal faces these, you know, not incorrect criticisms based around the fact that it's not complete. It doesn't address Iran's human rights track record and its kidnappings and its non-nuclear ballistic missile tests, but it wasn't designed to. It was designed to just contain in a limited way this one narrow band of behavior around nuclear progression, and it did that effectively. And there was no perfect deal that could have been an alternative. This was the best that we had, because we got to it too late and too many centrifuges were already going.
Right.
And likewise, I think any deal with North Korea, if we really want to invest in a diplomatic solution, is going to look imperfect. And there are going to be the human rights problems, and we are going to have to get to them later.
Right.
And correctly, that's going to make people angry.
Don't go away. The Michelle Meow Show continues right after this.
Babe, I think we're ready.
We're really doing this.
Yeah, I'm ready for our family.
So where do we start?
Starting a family is a team effort, and when life needs a little encouragement, Pacific Fertility Center will be right by your side. As a unified team of the best fertility specialists, guided by the highest ethical standards, Pacific Fertility Center provides patients with compassionate fertility care. Visit pacificfertilitycenter.com.
The Commonwealth Club is a unique organization that brings together people from a variety of backgrounds to explore important issues as a community. Sooner or later, everyone worth hearing comes to our stage. From Marga Gomez to Richard Chamberlain, from James Hormel to Kate Kendall, leading thinkers, activists, politicians, and artists have come to the Commonwealth Club of California. Ted Olson and David Boies came here to discuss their winning legal strategy for same-sex marriage. Jason Collins talked about gay athletes. The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence discussed activism and good works. Actor and director Rob Reiner explained how he got Hollywood behind same-sex marriage. Barney Frank described what it's like to be gay at the highest levels of Washington. From healthcare reform to transgender rights, from immigration to gay-owned businesses, it's all at the Commonwealth Club. And that's still just a portion of the 450 programs we present every single year, with new programming nearly every single day. Be a part of the conversation. Learn more at commonwealthclub.org, download our free app in iTunes, and join us in person the next time you're in San Francisco. The Commonwealth Club of California puts you face-to-face with today's thought leaders.
Right, absolutely. And your assessment of the leader of North Korea?
They make for quite a pair, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. I don't think he's quite as crazy, and although appalling as ever. Speaking of appalling, Harvey Weinstein. So, congratulations on your Pulitzer.
Thank you.
Well deserved.
Thank you to all of you for caring about this issue. Thank you to all of the sources. These women did an incredibly brave thing. They went through hell to do it.
How did you... This has been a story a lot of people... I know David Carr very well before he died, but he talked to me about this story quite a bit. I've heard so many people talking about this story over the years and Harvey Weinstein's behavior.
And you probably saw in one of those stories that I wrote, I uncovered the way in which David Carr was being intimidated and surveilled.
Yep.
And the way in which Harvey Weinstein really felt he had effectively intimidated him.
One of the things I want to make the observation, I've made it publicly before, is that it's also being able to see things in a different way from the victim's mentality and to be more empathetic. And I know that it's sort of a broader term, but I don't think it was a coincidence that these stories were broken by women and a gay man. Like, it just, you have an ability to see an empathetic thing and allow people to understand people's problems. And maybe you don't agree with me. It's my argument for diversity.
It's a fascinating point. I mean, I think that anyone who has felt othered or unseen or unheard probably has an elevated understanding of what survivors of sexual assault go through and the extent to which they frequently feel invisible in our culture.
Right.
You know, and that flowed from a number of part of my identity, including my sister being a survivor of sexual assault.
Right.
You know, I had people who were very dear to me confront this issue head on and had learned just how high the stakes are and how devastating the fallout is.
Right. And a lot of reporters say don't do something that's that close to you, but I think that's exactly the people to do that.
Well, I think that every reporter I respect draws a distinction. You know, you don't do something that's close to you in the sense that, you know, you have a personal relationship with the people directly
involved. Right, of course.
And I didn't. I have, you know, a perfectly lovely, superficial cocktail party relationship with Harvey Weinstein and no, you know, business relationship.
Not today, though, right? No.
No, that is past tense.
Right, okay.
I don't think he's at a lot of cocktail parties now. Although maybe in Arizona, whatever sex rehab he's at. I had no adverse feelings about him, but I did care passionately about the issue and feel close to it in the sense that I had some understanding of it. And I think, you know, every reporter that I respect, you know, agrees that that kind of drive is...
It creates a better
is only a good thing. You know, we all, you report on tech and you're close to that world and it, it makes you a better reporter in that world. And, you know, any matter that you feel a close affinity to and care about, I think you use that in whatever your profession is.
So how did you get these women to talk to you? Because I think that was the key part. That, to me, was astonishing. And the New York Times did also. But the interviews you did were particularly gripping. And they ripped your heart out, the stories of Annabella Shoria, all the others. How did you go about that? How did you... Because you had done it for... There's a lot of controversy about NBC not backing you, essentially. Mm-hmm. Are those reports correct that you were working on it? They didn't feel you. They say they didn't feel you had it. I've heard that from them, and I said I don't believe you in any way. So I don't believe what they said there. You felt like you didn't have support there, so you moved it over to the New Yorker.
I would say yes. It is publicly known, and everyone involved has admitted that the bulk of the year of reporting on this story happened at NBC and was intended to be for my Today Show investigative series, where I was already doing these kinds of sort of truth to power, large scale investigations, you know, deaths being covered up at a government nuclear plant, that, you know, contentious issues that sometimes touched on this very matter. So yes, it was intended to be for that.
So, and did you have trouble getting them on camera to talk, or was there issues around that?
No, the very first interview was an on the record, on camera interview, you know, with a prominent person accusing Harvey Weinstein of rape. So from the very beginning, this was clearly a high stakes story. And it very rapidly, the body of evidence expanded to an extraordinary extent. You know, that interview would have been January of last year. By April of last year, I had and had played for my entire, you know, editorial and corporate chain of command this extraordinary audio of Harvey Weinstein admitting to a sexual assault, which was made during the course of a police sting operation and had been buried for various reasons, some but not all of which have been made public. And I uncovered that. And, you know, there was a growing group of women saying, this is a safety issue, that this is a pattern, and I wish I had been warned, and maybe you can help warn the next woman. So it became impossible for me to stop at that point.
And so what caused you to move it? Like, they just wouldn't...
You know, I get this question all the time, obviously, and people are correct to ask. You know, the fact that there was a veil of silence around the Harvey Weinstein story for decades is not accidental, and there were a variety of systems that kept it...
Which you wrote about, which you also wrote about.
Many of which I wrote about, and, you know, the question of the complicity of the media and the role the media played in keeping this quiet for as long as it was quiet are important ones. And I think there will be more to say about that as time goes on and various investigations into this unfold. You know, I just want to make sure that I tell the story that I witnessed and reveal the evidence that I have in a careful way. And that it's also timed in a way that doesn't take away from the spotlight that is correctly placed on the women and their allegations.
At the time you were doing them.
So I've wanted to, you know, no reporter wants to become the story. And when there is, you know, a considerable story behind the story, you want to make sure that that doesn't come out at a time where it would eclipse the very hard-fought stories of these accusers.
We'll get to the idea of him trying to shut you down in a second. But what, when you started putting this together, finally, for David, who's an astonishing editor.
David Remnick is one of the best forces we have
in
journalism.
He's the editor of The
New Yorker. He's a real hero. He really champions the tough stories and is immensely principled.
Why did you go there? What was your... What you thought that was a place you could get the entire thing out?
Ken Oletta, who is a wonderful New Yorker
media writer,
had attempted to break this story for the
New
Yorker.
Many times. He did. He just talked about it with
several times, as early as the early aughts, you know, 2001, 2002. And I became aware that he had dug into this and had a number of accusers who had spoken to him and was struggling to get people on the record. And one of the most moving things about this story, in addition to the tremendous sacrifice and bravery of the women was also just how generous fellow reporters were.
Yeah, he told me.
I mean, to an extent, David Carr from the grave, essentially, because his widow was wonderful in helping me put together the puzzle pieces of his story, and his coworkers were generous in the same way. Ken Auletta literally gave his notes from
that
time.
That's what he told me, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I went into a dusty archive in the New York Public Library and sifted through all of these meticulous reporters' notebooks and, you know, found these contemporaneous accounts of conversations that backed up the things that I had been chasing and the sources that I had been talking to. So that was immensely helpful at a time where I was very much being gaslit and told this wasn't a story and was running into all sorts of obstacles in my career and in my life that were being arrayed around me because I wasn't stopping. It was a lifeline to have fellow reporters say, no, there's something here, keep going. And Ken was one of those people.
What do you think the breakthrough moment of that was for you? What was the second where you're like, aha, now I have him?
I think anytime you hear a literal recording of someone of that stature admitting to it, it's pretty cut and dry, although obviously that didn't stop many people from trying to squash it even after that point.
And also squash her, like try to ruin her.
Yes, yes. There were whole systems arrayed against not only me and reporters working on this, but also, of course, against the women, including Ambra Badalana Gutierrez, who was the woman in that tape, who is an incredibly savvy and strong person and did a really brave thing that she didn't have to do. With no prospect of gain, you know, the argument that was constantly weaponized against her was that she was some kind of a hustler and she was in it to turn a buck. And all I can say is she did not have to go back to Harvey Weinstein wearing a wire, terrified. And there was no deal for her at the other end of that. There was nothing she got out of that except maybe preventing another woman from getting in the same situation. And she did a number of really brave things in the course of this reporting and was smeared terribly throughout.
And the other women, when they started to speak on their record, why now do you think they did decide to do it? Because again, I remember with David and Ken, they wouldn't do it. What do you think changed?
I think that the world changed, Kara. There was a progression of brave women and also now, of course, eventually men. And I don't want to discount the importance of male survivors of sexual violence and how much we need to hear their voices. But at the time, it was mostly women coming forward and chipping away at the culture of silence. And that was true of Cosby's accusers, who spoke out at a time where it's easy for us to forget now as this, you know, court verdict against him is hailed as a victory for human rights. When they first spoke out, and I was having these fights in newsrooms wanting to cover that, they were terribly smeared. It was a 50-50 split between serious coverage of their stories and op-eds saying, but wait, look at his cultural contribution. You know, look at what he did for race. Look at what he did for comedy. You know, a lot of men, it really was a gendered reaction, you know, writing these spirited defenses of him and assisting in the takedowns of these women. And, you know, I remember and have written about fights that I had where, for instance, I would have on my cable news program Cosby's official biographer, Mark Whitaker, who didn't mention the allegations in the biography. And I just knew about them through the grapevine and had read about, you know, the various aborted legal processes and wanted to ask a question. You know, why didn't you include that? Is it ethical for you to exclude that? And I got terrible pushback, you know, and not all of it from a conscious place of evil or even cowardice. Just people saying, well, that's not the way we do this in polite company. Why would you ask about that? That's not in the headlines.
It is interesting because that happens all the time. I remember Gabriel Sherman, who did a great job on Ailes later. I remember sitting with him. I go, why was this not? None of this was in your book. And he's like, the women wouldn't talk. I couldn't get them. I tried. I said, did you try real hard? Did you try real hard? I go, not hard enough. You know, we had a really great discussion about it. And at least he was willing to talk about it. And similarly, I had a Commonwealth Club with Adam Leshinsky. And he wrote an entire book about Uber without discussing the sexism and the sexual harassment and everything else there. And I was like, how was that?
I hope there's a lesson for every journalist tackling a story where there's a little voice saying, hey, there's this other thing, and it's right. maybe impolite to raise it.
Right.
But it might look really bad if you don't right. in retrospect.
Right.
And I do hope that that's a cautionary tale for people. And I think in this case, it was the women who penetrated that veil of silence against all odds and broke through with the odd story here. And, mm-hmm. That's the Cosby accusers. It's my sister. Mm-hmm. It's Gretchen Carlson talking about the situation at Fox. Yep. Those were precedents that I was able to point to when I had these conversations with women over months and months and months as they turned over, okay, if I relive the worst trauma of a lifetime and put my trust in you as a reporter and take this risk that I will be wiped out career-wise mm-hmm. and maybe threatened in terms of my physical safety, what happens at the end? Am I ever heard? And citing those precedents, I was able to give them a glimmer of hope. You know, not a great glimmer, but mm-hmm. something, some shred of hope that they would be heard.
Don't go away. The Michelle Meow Show continues right after this.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.
Weatherford BMW is where I spend a lot of my time. I love what I do and I love the people I work with, but work's not the only thing I love. I love the everyday simple things in life, like mornings at my favorite coffee shop, taking walks with my dogs around Point Isabel, and spoiling my partner for a scenic but thrilling ride. That's the beauty of living the Bay Area dream. We're just being ourselves, living our authentic life.
Live your authentic life, a special message by Weatherford BMW.
Eventually. What was your convincing argument to them?
Well, so it was telling them that the world had changed mm-hmm. and that speaking out about this after those other precedents was going to be different, that we were in the midst of a sea change. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have anticipated how much that was true.
Right, yeah.
But I sensed that that was happening and I was able to point to the beginnings of it. And then it was about altruism. Every single woman who went on the record about Harvey Weinstein did it because they
right.
wanted to help the next woman.
Right.
And they wanted to help the culture. And they did it, I guarantee you, looking at much more downside than upside.
Right.
And it was still important enough to them that they help. And not everyone made that decision. There were women that I was talking to for months and months who ultimately decided they weren't going to help.
It looks like there were some that were, and then later shifted.
Every variation of that.
Yeah.
There were women who never decided to go on the record. There were women who, did a gradual progression of going on background as an anonymous source and then going fully on the record. There were women who were out and then in and then back out and then back in. Mm-hmm. And that, too, is part of reporting on these stories.
Right.
This is a reporting process that forces people to relive the worst trauma they ever knew.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a rough ride. And, I'm still dealing with sources going through hell
right.
trying to tell stories that haven't yet broken.
I want to get to the questions from people in a second, but talk about people, what the repercussions now are. What do you imagine? Where are we now? Are we in this post-Me Too era or still in the... you don't have to place us, but what do you imagine is happening now? Because you've seen this come out in orchestras, in art, in architecture, in tech, in everywhere pretty much. It's a lot in media, a whole lot in media and Hollywood.
I think one reason why I structured those stories and the incredible team at The New Yorker structured those stories with me around systems rather than individuals is because the systems still have a long way to go.
Right.
And, this in my mind was never a story about Harvey Weinstein or a story about the entertainment industry. This was a story about the abuse of power and the way in which the most powerful people in this country can manipulate the press,
mm-hmm.
manipulate the judicial and legal process. In Harvey Weinstein's case, directly influence a DA's office
mm-hmm.
In a really breathtaking way. you know, smear people, intimidate people. I mean, for crying out loud, hire combat-ready former Mossad agents to assume false identities.
Right.
And
makes
follow
them think
people.
They're crazy. Right. It makes someone think they're gaslighting
people. Yeah, and insinuate themselves into people's lives and go after women and go after reporters. I mean, these are systems that are still being used every day. I mean, I am...
You've written about AMI, the president's David Pecker and those still in place with McDougal and Stormy Daniels.
Yes. So that's a great example of the through line here, where these are common systems employed by multiple powerful people seeking to silence opposition. You know, what Kara's referring to is I've broken a number of stories in the last few months about secret election season payments to cover up stories on behalf of the president. And those were undertaken through an intermediary that Harvey Weinstein also used, American Media Inc., the parent company of the National Enquirer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talk about how that company and a number of others were used by, you know, this echelon of wealthy and influential person to smear people that they wanted to take off the map and to
pay off of.
Yeah, and to undertake secret payments to keep stories out of the media. And in the case of Trump, out of the political narrative in the crucial window before Americans went to the polls.
Right. And where does this end now? I mean, obviously there's a state, Michael Cohen's been, they're investigating that. It's gonna slow roll, presumably, for a little bit.
Well, we know that the Southern District of New York, mm-hmm. when they undertook the search warrants of various premises owned by Michael Cohen, you know, one of the express aims, the Times has reported, was to go after communications between Michael Cohen and AMI and the National Enquirer. Mm-hmm. There are a number of other proceedings ongoing that are looking at these systems with respect to both the president and with respect to Harvey Weinstein. I think there will be a lot more unfolding in terms of the justice system and how it confronts these issues finally after so many years of them being in the shadows. And mm-hmm. you know, until we see the results of that, I'm reluctant to say that we have put any of this behind us.
Right, until they get either dismantled or exposed.
Presumably. Yeah, you look at every pillar of complicity that I reported on over the fall, and a lot of those are still thriving, whether it's corruption in the justice system or complicity in the media. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be a lot more to say about all of those things.
And what happens to Harvey Weinstein?
You know, I get asked this question a lot, and forgive me if this is kind of an annoying answer, because it's a dodge, but it's a sincere dodge and with a good intention, which is, you know, yes, there are ongoing proceedings, and I'm, you know, in contact with brave law enforcement officers who, you know, are very committed to not dropping the ball and the way the ball has been dropped in the past with respect to Harvey Weinstein. But I would just caution everyone that I think it's a misstep to become fixated on the taking down of men and the specific men who were behind some of these crimes. This, for me, and I know that this is the sentiment of a lot of the survivors I talked to, was always about the survivors. This was about taking stories that hadn't been heard for so long and putting a spotlight on them and making sure these brave women felt heard and seen. And I think the moment we start turning back to the spotlight being on Harvey Weinstein or any of these alleged predators, it detracts a little bit from the focus being
from the
on
stories.
Yeah, on the women and
the
allegations.
Do you imagine there's a fatigue now of this? I don't think there is, but I think anger is a good thing.
It's not really for me to say. You mean on the part of the culture?
Culture, yeah.
I hope that there is no fatigue for justice or accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I hope not.
All right, let's answer some questions. That's a great question. Okay, how do you produce on such a high level? I want to know that too, besides being a young man. What are your keys to success in this arena?
Right, I'm very stubborn. Mm-hmm. I think any source who has been hounded by me will tell you I can be extremely annoying.
I've heard that.
And persistent. I also hope that I bring a certain level of compassion to these conversations. I certainly aspire to. You know, there were women who ultimately decided not to put their name on their mm-hmm. stories. And that, of course, is always disappointing as a reporter, but I always respected mm-hmm. those wishes, and not every outlet that reported on this did that. You know, there were people who used names without permission, and you know, I'm not demonizing that. Every reporter makes different calls, mm-hmm. but I just felt, having seen my sister live through this and knowing what a personal experience it was important to make sure that they had the opportunity to consent in every way and really control their destinies. And I think giving sources that latitude is probably part
of... What about your own energy levels? I mean, you're...
I don't sleep a lot.
Okay.
I really need to. Mm-hmm. I would probably be a lot more likable if I slept ever. I don't manage my time well at all. I mean, this last period was crazy.
It's like you work a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this was really like working on the Weinstein stories until 2 a.m. at One World Trade in New York, and then going home and like typing until my fingers were bleeding, and turning in a draft of War on Peace at like 10 a.m., and then collapsing for 3 hours, and then going back to work. So I was just, you know, I wasn't eating, I wasn't sleeping, I was, you know, my poor partner, who you know, was like taking calls from me, and I'm, you know, falling apart constantly. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, they're coming after me, and they're trying to kill me, and I'm, you know, I have no job. And he's like, yeah, I got a life too. I can't do this all the time.
Yeah. John, his partners don't love it. Pain in the ass, but I love it.
You know, and I was really lucky to also have a great support system in that respect. Yeah. My mom is wonderful.
Yeah.
And really instilled a really strong sense of public service. Thank you, guys.
I saw her at the...
She deserves that applause. And I would extend that to any strong single mom out there. I just learned so much watching her and, you know, admire her so much.
I saw you at the Time 100. She looked thrilled.
Yeah.
That was a cute picture.
She's the sweetest. Yeah. She's a fan of yours.
Yeah. Would you define the U.S. as a dying empire? What can we do to preserve the republic? Or is it too late? Oh, well.
Oh, that's cheerful.
Yeah.
I do not.
We did have that civil war, and we managed to recover from it, so perhaps.
We've recovered from a lot.
Yes, we have. We have a terrible history.
I do not think that War on Peace is a eulogy. Mm-hmm. I view it as actually quite optimistic in the end. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have bothered writing the thing if I didn't think there was a way out. And the last section of the book is actually devoted to profiling how you can turn things around. And it uses some of those examples from the Obama administration, mm-hmm. where the first part of the book you know, kind of lays waste to the Obama administration and the ways in which it screwed this up, and the ways in which that is sort of a microcosm for the more mm-hmm. extreme ills happening now. But the end is really about looking at the turnaround and the lessons we can derive from that. And I think that there is a roadmap to pulling out of the nosedive. And mm-hmm. I think that as I said, as much as there are fears about Mike Pompeo coming in, there's also a lot of hope, and there's a lot resting on his shoulders and the shoulders of the next administration that comes in.
Okay, all right. Harvey Weinstein, War and Diplomacy, what's next?
I am hard at work at my next New Yorker story.
Okay.
I am starting my HBO deal. Mm-hmm.
You know,
and I had to make the complicated decision whether to go back to the morning TV, you know, reading spaghetti recipes with Matt Lauer in the Plaza type thing.
No, Matt Lauer is gone.
I would not have been going back to him, but you know, the equivalent.
He's gone.
And I decided in the end that, you know, as much as I, like anyone else, is vulnerable to the shiny thing of a lot of airtime, one of the lessons of this series of stories is if you go really deep and work your ass off for a long time to get it right, mm-hmm. People respond to that and it resonates in a really special way. So the HBO deal is kind of a cool one-off.
It's
in
a new
that,
show.
I mean, honestly, they are letting me shape it to whatever degree of frequency I want. I think that trying to heed that lesson, I will likely do less frequent, very, very in-depth, you know, documentary miniseries mm-hmm. Around hopefully the biggest stories in America. Yeah. And that will be, you know, shared with the reporting that I'm already doing in print and along the same lines about abuses of power and cover-ups. And I was heartbroken that I didn't get the chance to tell those stories visually. If you look mm-hmm. at the progression of the investigations I was doing on television, you can see the direction that was going in, and I'm excited that I have the chance to tackle that.
Well, you're a pretty decent reporter from what I can understand here.
So are you, Kara. Yeah, so I appreciate hearing that.
Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kara. Isn't she great?
Thank you for joining us for a Commonwealth Club of California program presented by Week to Week, airing on the Michelle Miao Show on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm John Zipperer, and you can join us Thursdays when I co-host with Michelle before a live audience at the Commonwealth Club in downtown San Francisco. Join us for an upcoming program and find out more about the club and how you can become involved at commonwealthclub.org/MMS.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.